the history we tell is inherently story-based, it's inherently built on our pre-understandings, and that the Enlightenment historical method is just one more pre-understanding that you bring to the possible telling of historical events.
Hello, and welcome to Faith at the Frontiers, a podcast that confronts challenges to the Christian faith with hope. Continuing our series on faith and the challenges of history, we move in this episode from questions about Old Testament scholarship to a discussion of the historical method in general. Joining us today is Seth Herringer, Associate Professor of Theology and Scripture at Toccoa Falls College in Georgia. He is the author of Uniting History and Theology, A Theological Critique of the Historical Method. I hope you enjoy listening.
We're really grateful to have you on the show, Seth. So thanks for joining.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate being here and talking about one of my passions, right? History.
Yeah. So we're talking about the challenge that history can pose for Christians. Very often the way that history's done or the results that historians come up with can seem to conflict with what Christians believe. And there's no place where that is more evident than with some of the historical claims made by the New Testament. How has your work sort of engaged with that challenge?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. When I think about how I started on this path, I was in a New Testament theology class with Kevin Rowe at Duke. And he allowed me into an upper level session. I was a master's student. He allowed me into one of his PhD sessions on New Testament theology. And we were reading Trelch's, and again, we can talk about that later, but he's a German thinker who basically talked
very
about
very influential theologian from the early 20th century, is that right?
Yeah. And so he's helped biblical scholars and theologians think about, and in some ways that I think are actually helpful, in some ways I don't like, but we can delve into him later, but to make a long story short, he sets up some principles of historical criticism. And I remember sitting around that dissertation room, right, with the conference table there with, some people who have gone on to be, really good New Testament scholars, written lots of books. And Kevin, who's also, a heavyweight New Testament scholar. And we just sat there puzzled on how do we take what Trelch is saying seriously and still be Christians, basically, right?
I know that feeling. People seem to get that feeling a lot when they go and study theology at graduate level.
Yeah. And how can we do this thing called the historical method when its principles seem to be contradictory and inherently contradictory to the Christian story and the Christian narrative? And really, I'm sure Kevin had an answer, right? But he let us sit there and uncomfortable. And I remember just leaving that dissertation room, just being like puzzled, somewhat taken aback, and being like, I think I need to work on this. And so that was sort of the foundations of my book.
But you didn't lose your faith.
I did not. I knew that was not where I wanted to go.
It's good to know where this podcast episode is heading.
Yes. No, instead of losing my faith, I mean, actually, my whole project is, and I look at some, part of my project is looking at modern theologians and biblical scholars and how they interact with this question of faith history. And one of the things I found is that often, which is funny what you were saying, Barnabas, which is like you have to either adjust your faith, which many do, or you have to adjust your historical method, which not many people, which they do, but they don't say that they do it. So that there's almost like a game playing where...
Yeah, people pretend they're abiding by the rules, but they somehow still arrive at Orthodox Christian conclusions. And you've got to wonder, how do you get to Christian conclusions using this method?
And so that is something that I have discovered, and something that I thought more about then, is that instead of changing my faith, I have decided that, and I think that the right solution is actually developing a Christian understanding of, I don't want to say a method, but approach or a Christian way of thinking about history that is not beholden to, subject to, disciplined by the historical method that's coming out of like Trelch and von Ranke and so other thinkers like that.
Really interesting. Can we unpack for a minute? Because what I think most people would have expected you to say is not that the historical method's principles themselves contradict the Christian faith, but that the results of those principles, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So people are very animated on the question, did Jesus rise from the dead? Is there historical evidence for whether Jesus rose from the dead or not? And what they're interested in is the results, but they're not really turning and having a look at the method itself by which we arrive at those results.
I think, like, we'll just start with Trollope. I think he's probably the most important thinker for biblical scholars. There's another important thinker before him, which is von Ranke, but that's not terribly necessary for what we're talking about here. And this is actually that paper that we read in that class was, this is Trelch's paper on the historical and dogmatic method, and where he says, and this is my entryway into what the historical method is and the principles, or at least some of them, some of the early formulations. And then we can talk about, you know, where they're at now, but this is still the foundations that actually I think a lot of biblical scholarship and theologians are still working from. Part of my also work is saying the current philosophy of history has sort of changed, but we're still working with sort of older understanding. And so we're going to talk about that now, which is this Trelchian understanding. And so he's attacking another guy named Niebuhrgal, who's saying, listen, so Trelch is saying, listen, theologians, people who do dogmatics, you Christian people, which he was Christian too, but as we'll see in somewhat of a different way, but he would claim himself to be Christian. Later on in his life, he sort of rejected Jesus as the ultimate, but that's a different story. But he says, listen.
So he's still operating with a self-understanding of being a Christian at this point.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so he says, listen, but he's still attacking sort of these, he calls them dogmaticians or dogmatic theology, and says, you love the historical method because you see that it has all these, you know, in the Enlightenment and passed into modernity, where it's like that these methods have fruit. They produce fruit. They do things that are powerful. Scientific method does things that are powerful. The historical method does things that are powerful, that produce knowledge. And he says, you guys love all that knowledge it produces, and you want to play by the rules of the historical method until like it impinges upon something you really care about. And then you sort of draw back and say, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to do something different. And he says, that's inconsistent, that you are being hypocrites and that you're using our method up until like it starts to hurt. And then as soon as it starts to hurt, you say, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And that's the challenge he laid to them. And in that conversation, he says, here is, you know, what he says are the three principles of the historical critical method. And he says, you need to keep applying these all the way through. And he even says it's like 11, right? He says, the problem is once you let these in, you can't pull them back because they just spread and multiply like leaven does. And you don't understand the power of the method.
And you have to apply the same principles consistently all the way through.
Yes, so you don't understand.
He's basically saying people are happy to accept everything that historians are saying until they say something that contradicts their faith. And then they'll suddenly be like, no, we don't accept that.
Yep.
You're like, why are you accepting everything else that historians are saying if you will check out when they say something that contradicts your faith?
And the theologians are using the historical method to have a kind of academic legitimacy. They're saying what we're doing is just as legitimate as the other disciplines, but except when we don't like where it leads us, and then we can sort of jump ship.
Right, exactly. And we should come back to that public question some point in this conversation. I think that's actually a really key question, is the public nature of what we're doing. But yeah, he says, listen, you've already let the leaven into the lump of bread dough, right? You can't just like pull it back now. And so these, you know, and then he states them. He says three of them, right? These have become very famous in biblical scholars' understanding of what they're doing and in theologians what they're doing. This is anytime someone talks about history, they talk about these Trelch's three methods, and so, or three parts of the method. And so I think it'd be useful to your listeners to hear these.
Yeah.
First one is criticism, which is, that
doesn't mean being critical in the sense of criticizing in the common usage, right?
No, it doesn't mean that. It means that he means that, like, listen, if we have sort of a medieval sense of the world, anything that's religious or that the church says is raised up onto a platform, we just assume that it's true. And for him, criticism means, no, we have to make everything even and level. There's no claims, there's no authorities that give a claim inherent truthfulness to it. So
right,
everything so has to be brought down to a neutral level.
So with every other ancient text, you know, that we read, we're happy to ask ourselves whether or not it actually happened, whether or not it's actually true. And he's saying, well, if we want to be consistent, we want to do that with the Bible as well. When we read the Bible, just don't just assume that it's true, but test whether or not it's true the same way we would test any other text.
Yes, exactly. Jesus is not special because he's the Son of God. You mean you must treat him like every other object to be investigated, the person to be investigated in history, and his claims are not special. Paul's claims are not special. The New Testament claims are not special. They don't have any inherent authority to them. Everything has to be investigated on a neutral playing field. It's the leveling of all claims onto one field so that they can all be investigated the same. And then, so that's the first one, criticism, right? Sort of sets the grounds on an even playing field. And then the next one is analogy, which has become very controversial. I was saying some analogy. Some of those modern theologians and biblical scholars end up trying to reject his use of analogy. So this is because we can see now this is going to start impinging upon the Christian story. And this is that, listen, it's basically simple. The past is like the present, right? And things that you see in the present happen in the past. Things that you don't see happening in the present didn't happen in the past. So I know these are my own examples, but I kind of like think of some kind of, you know, fun ones. He's like, listen, do you see Athena fighting for the city of Athens? And you say, well, no. You know, like I don't see Greek goddesses coming down and waging battle on behalf of her city. And he was like, guess what? That didn't happen in the past either. That wasn't real.
Oh, and gosh. So, oh, I see. You mean, so he's saying, because we don't see gods and goddesses at war today, that means that they weren't at war in the past.
That's
either.
Right. Though that's my example of a kind of complex of a kind of complex subject. But that's basically what he's saying. You see kings being overthrown by ambitious underlings, and you'd be like, well, yeah, I see something very similar to that, right? Like that makes sense. People are trying to seek political power and do evil things. Well, did that happen in the past? Yeah, the stories that then talk about kings being overthrown by underlings have an inherent likelihood. Now, again, they're not for sure that they happened, but there's an inherent likelihood there that those sorts of things happen today, they happen in the past, right? A similar of human nature and experiences across
time. So we can judge whether or not things in the past happened by whether or not they describe things that we've seen happen today.
Yeah, and probably even more likely is the things that don't happen today didn't happen in the past. Do you see resurrections happening today? You know what I mean? No, I look around, I don't see any resurrections today. Well, they didn't happen in the past either, right? The world has not changed. The fundamental nature of the world has not changed between then and now.
Yeah. So if there's no current analogy for what this is saying happened in the past, then it probably didn't happen then.
Yes. Yep. So that's his second one. And you can see now where this starts impinging, right? Mm-hmm. Onto the Christian narrative of saying, okay, well, that becomes problematic. And we can see people like Pannenberg and N.T. Wright start trying to adjust the principle of analogy later on when they're still trying to keep some of the principles of the circular method, but they don't like, you know, exactly how he uses them.
Well, it means effectively, I mean, this may be jumping ahead in your argument, but it sure seems to me that means nothing could ever have happened that's unique.
Right,
which rules out the possibility of a unique thing.
Right, and so there is some nuances there, and that's what N.T. Wright says, right, is that this destroys unique, and Pannenberg says something similar. And I think there is some truth to that problem with this one. Although I think he's not an absolutist on this, you know, he does allow for development through time and things like that, right? So, but it has to be sort of like plausible within the world of the present.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. You mean like, can you sort of see how could this have happened in the modern day world? You know, can we sort of see how this could have happened in the past? Do these sort of things happen in the modern? Are there certain things that we know can have happened? You know, like things like, again, it's mostly things like magic and defying gravity and flying. You know, we know human beings can't fly. So stories in the past about these magical events, supernatural things, did not happen in the past because we don't see them happening today. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I think one of the guys I'm talking about said something like the airplane. Would the principle of analogy outrule the development of an airplane? It going sort of go in the reverse. Mm-hmm. And I think Trelch would be okay with something. No, I can understand how like there is scientific development. It's not that. It's more like a break with reality that you currently know.
The laws of nature don't change.
Yeah, stuff like that.
It's also, you know, it gets applied really broadly because it's things like motivations, human motivations. So we'll say like, I don't know, does a king usually act really altruistically when he does this? Or is he usually trying to get power? Usually they're after power. So maybe that story is right. So there are also these kinds of analogy functions really broadly about what we think life is like, we sort of
especially
put
on human nature as well.
Yeah,
human nature
that's
doesn't
right.
change.
Yeah, so just the sense
that's
that
good. Yep, totally.
Things were kind of functioning similarly then, so that's going to determine how we understand these kinds of claims. Yeah.
Yep, really helpful. And then the last one is correlation, which is basically cause and effect through time, which says anything that happens in history has to be fully explainable by previous causes. So the example that I give is, the teachings of Jesus have to be fully explainable from ancient Near Eastern, Greco-Roman, you know, Jewish, whatever it is, influences, and nothing sort of new can happen with Jesus. Nothing completely new that's a break from the past. There's no outside injection of knowledge from God, from the heavens. You know what I mean? It all is sort of has to be naturally developed from the ideas of the time period.
The sort of natural chain of cause and effect
that
you see in history, and then everything that we see today is an effect of a cause in history.
Yeah, and that there can be no outside causation changing that.
So it kind of rules out the supernatural. It rules out supernatural intervention, right?
Yeah, totally rules supernatural. And so that's why when I say that the rules of the historical method, now I get that that's a complicated term, and people who do the historical method may not like me saying this is the historical method, but this has become a very influential understanding of the historical method, is inherently contradictory to the Christian faith.
That's the principles themselves, not just the results. In fact, the results follow naturally from those principles.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one of the things, if we were going to claim, because you'll often see, if we talk about historians and say like, oh, they're proceeding naturalistically, we're not talking about their personal beliefs, right? So you can be a historian who believes that supernatural things happen, who possesses religious faith, but then uses these principles, right? And the question is, well, you're still going to get naturalistic results no matter what you personally believe, all right? That's, I think, one of the interesting things here. And so oftentimes people will say, well, no, that scholar's a Christian, so that's not what's happening, right? And it's like, well, that's actually not necessarily relevant to the question. The question is, what method, what principles are they using?
Well, I guess people sometimes feel like they have to hide their own faith commitments when they're doing their writing of books.
Well, you know, that's a really fascinating thing. It's just a second segue here. You know, I wrote a different article on New Testament theology. And in there actually are people arguing that like books can be theological, but they have to be like hidden theological. And so they literally say things like you need to hide your biases and your theology. And this is how to do it well, is to hide your biases and your theology so that you can make descriptive accounts of the past and of the Bible and sort of bracket your own theological beliefs, but it's still theological because you yourself have theological beliefs, but those theological beliefs can't make it into the actual text that you're writing because that would make them not descriptive and neutral anymore. You know what I mean? And so that's exactly, like when you say hiding, that's exactly what people are saying you should do as a biblical scholar, as a Christian.
Gosh.
Because that's how you play the method well and play that's how you complete the method and can participate in these wider conversations. And so your job as a good biblical scholar is to literally hide it and purposely hide it.
Okay. Can we just zoom out for a second? So you're saying that these three principles laid down by Troeltsch, early 20th century, that they'd be very, very influential. So many biblical scholars that we might read today would be influenced by these principles, including perhaps the biblical scholars we've already interviewed on this podcast.
Yeah. So that's a kind of a complicated question in that I do think... I want to be careful here. This is absolutely influential. This is absolutely really influential on what the historical method I still think is today. And now the question of is it influential on biblical scholars? I would say two things. One, biblical scholars want to be public, and so they want to play by the historical method. And at the same time, they want to reject certain parts of these. And so what they do is something I call historical criticism plus, which I reject, right? Which is they say things like, I want to do historical criticism, but I'm going to sort of have the addition of God in the end, like a little plus, right? And I want to say, I understand what you're trying to do, but I don't think that's a helpful route. I think that the principles are so inherently contradictory to God that to put a little plus at the end and say, oh no, but I think God is possible. Really, the problem with the historical method is that it inherently rules out God. I want to be like, yes, it is. So we should reject the historical method, not try to add a little plus at the end.
Well, I quite like my Samsung Galaxy S22 Plus. That's not quite the same thing you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it is influential. And so here's a simple example I always give to let people know, like, I think I get pushback. People say, well, you know, Seth, this is not really the historical method and people don't really believe these and it's not really naturalistic. But I want to say, okay, if you were to try to submit an article to the American Historical Review, which is the AHA's one of the most prestigious journals in history, maybe not the most, but you know, it's up there. And you want to make any sort of supernatural claim or any sort of outside, like any claim that goes against these principles. And, you know, the example I give in the book is if you want to say like, listen, the reason that Lee made the very uncharacteristic mistake during the Civil War to send Pickett up Cemetery Hill, which is sort of against good military tactics. He never made a mistake like that before. If you want to say, you know, again, that the reason this happened is because God decided the stench of slavery was so great that he said, you know, this is time for it to be over and Lee's going to make a mistake. Now, again, we're probably all uncomfortable with that claim.
So to suggest that God actually intervened in history and that's a cause of some historical event happening.
Yeah, that would be laughed out of the room. That would be, anything like that would just be like laughed at, and they wouldn't even get, like, it wouldn't even get an intellectual glance. And maybe we're all like, yeah, you know, that's really weird. I don't want that to be history. Like, you know, how can we think of God being a supernatural cause? But I want to say for Christians, like, we should have that glance at that. No, I don't know if I think that's what the case is. And I don't know even how we necessarily would even find that out. But the historical method laughs at anything that says, like, there is some sort of outside cause that will come in and change the world. And that's exactly what Christians think happened. That's in our creed. The outside cause is, the Son of God becomes incarnate in the baby Jesus. And that is an outside cause coming in to change the world. And so when the historical Christianism laughs at the resurrection or laughs at the incarnation, I don't think that we should be surprised by that, because that still is what's going on. That's what happened. Again, I mean, Trelch, again, his religious identity is complicated, but these principles, like, they don't hold back on the answer to the resurrection. They don't hold back on the answer to the incarnation. The answer is clearly no, that did not happen. Just like in the, if you were to submit an article to the American Historical Review that would say somehow God is a cause in the world, the answer they would give you is no, we don't talk about that. That's against our method. And so I would say, yes, this method still very much is at play in the broader world.
I see.
And that this is the functioning historical method that's gone on in the guild. And biblical scholars want to play by the rules of the guild. And so they want to follow these same rules for a public conversation, for credibility, but they struggle to try to figure out, how do I fit by these rules and still remain a Christian?
I see.
And so, I hide my Christianity. I hide my supernatural causation. I hide all these things so I can sort of play by the rules of the game, when I think the rules of the game are inherently atheist and non-Christian and naturalistic.
Very interesting. Can I just spell out what you're saying in my own words?
Because, you know, yeah, totally.
A lot of people listening might be thinking, well, I read biblical scholars and they're Christians and they're suggesting very Christian interpretations of the Bible. So what's the problem? And basically, it seems to me what you're saying is they may be Christians and they may be making exceptions in the case of, like, the resurrection, but they're still ultimately using a method that is unchristian in its origins and in its principles. That's sort of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like Trelch, right? I actually think Trelch is, as much as I disagree with him, I actually think his criticism was probably pretty good, which is that I think that they're doing what this Niebuhrgall guy did, which is they're playing with the rules of the historical method as long as they want for the sake of public conversation, for the sake of wanting to reach wider audiences, for the sake of, again, if you take a cynical view, for the sake of jobs and renown. Now, again, I don't want to look into people's hearts, and I probably don't even think that's the case most of the time. I really think it probably is for public conversation and an interest in having good discussions, but that they're not criticizing the method in ways that is necessary for Christians to be doing, or they're not showing the ways in which this method is inherently naturalistic, and they're sort of trying to play by the rules of the historical method without identifying its inherent atheism and its inherent naturalism. And so that's what I think is going on. Now, I think there are lots of good Christians doing work. I would just push them to say, listen, you're not doing the historical method. You should stop pretending you're doing the historical method. Be boldly Christian, because your work already is Christian. And we need to start thinking carefully about how, as Christians, to develop a new historical method, develop a new approach to history, to try to find new ways of talking about it that doesn't sort of just slide back into the comfortable historical method language, because that is inherently atheistic and you're not doing that anyways. So let's just do something else. That's basically what my appeal is to biblical scholars, theologians, to say, like, stop pretending, stop playing the game, and just be boldly Christian and offer that up to the world as a possibility, right? Say, here's how we as Christians see the world. We see the world as a place, you know, loaded with God's supernatural intent, loaded with God's supernatural action. That is, it's even the split between the nature and supernatural is probably even the wrong way to talk about it, right? Because the world is
because it's all created by God, including the natural. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so that this is the world we have of an integrated, of the story from creation to new creation that tells a story of God's outworking of his plan for the world. And that is, and that we should just start telling that story, start doing history from that foundations, not from the foundations of some method that's inherently atheistic.
And you, I think what's so interesting, Seth, some of the work that you've done to get to that idea that we should develop a boldly Christian approach to history, you also critique what our idea of historical criticism is, right? You have a pretty robust critique for anybody who's applying this, the kind of Trollchian approach, whether they're Christians or not. And I think that's really important, because it's not just saying for non-Christians, this is history, and for Christians, this is history. But actually, there are some important unresolved questions about what does it mean to do history well? And we're at a state today where historians broadly in all kinds of disciplines have agreed that generally we're trying to do this sort of thing that you've sort of laid out. And they've done all kinds of great work, right? We have all kinds of interesting insights about the past. There's nothing to denigrate that. But I think lingering are some pretty serious questions about the methods that they're using. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about some of the kind of criticisms that have come of this approach in recent years.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just do two things. There's a backwards looking and a forward looking, I think, which is helpful. So one of the backwards looking thing is that I argue that Trelch and von Ranke actually aren't the naturalists that people think they are, which I actually think is an important point, that there's actually a misreading by biblical scholars and theologians of their projects.
Can we define nationalism quickly?
Basically what I'm just saying, that naturalism would be God cannot enter into the world to cause...
which is not necessarily atheism. There may be a God, but if there is a God, he doesn't do anything in the world. The world sort of is a self-contained package. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sure. That's a good distinction. Yeah. But that Trelch and von Ranke, they were idealists, German idealists, which is confusing because I know there's this term. Let me just say quickly how I define German idealism. Which is, because there's lots of different ways to define that, which is this idea that there is underneath the chaos of history, like the events of history that are sort of all seeming chaotic, underneath there is like an underlying principle. There's something driving history forward. There's something uniting the historical events together. And they all call these different things, God, the principle, the idea,
spirit.
Whatever.
Yeah.
What's that?
Spirit is what Hegel calls it.
Right, the spirit. Yep. There's something driving history, uniting it together. And both von Ranke and Trelch believe that, right? And they actually called it God, right? They seem there's some other Christian language came out in here. At different times, von Ranke changed a little bit later, but in general, right, they have this idea that there is something driving underneath, pushing it forward, uniting it. So it's not just, bare nature alone.
It's just blind chaos.
Right, yeah, just blind chaos, not just bare nature, but they did think that there was something underneath. And they were, and then von Ranke in particular was interested in things like beauty and the aesthetics and how do I make, and he thought that was tied into with this underlining ideal. So part of my criticism is if you look back to the people who they say are the founders of this idea, weren't the modern, scientific naturalism of some of the historical method that we have today. They were very interested in trying to think, how do these epochs of time show us this underlining ideal or show us God? They were very interested in that conversation. And we're like, that's nowhere on the page today, right? Mm-hmm. No one's using that part of German idealism. So that's the backwards-looking thing. The forward-looking part is that in the philosophy of history that's being done today, there's been a lot of challenges to these, what I call the historical method.
Right, and so you're not the only person asking questions about these principles.
That's right.
No, and that was actually what I thought was one of the more, I would say, unique parts of my dissertation was trying to bring in modern philosophy of history into the conversation that theologians and biblical scholars are having. Because biblical scholars and theologians are so busy reading the Bible and trying to keep up with their field.
And reading other theologians. Yeah.
Yes, they're not really paying attention to what is happening in the historical guild. And so one of my chapters was trying to figure out, or part of my work is trying to figure out, what is going on over here. And I bring in some ideas to talk about how even the ideal of the historical guild method actually has some problems to it. And there's a guy named Dante, Arthur Dante, who's a philosopher who has some really interesting...
Arthur Dante, criticism. I've heard of him.
Yeah. No, he's done some really interesting work on history. Let me just set up one thing. I think this is important to the listeners to see how I understand history, to understand this Dante piece, is when I think of history and what I argue history is the events we live and then the stories we tell about them. That's history. The two key terms are events... and then like stories or narratives.
Very interesting. Yeah, people often distinguish between history and historiography, right? And sometimes we use the word history as if it was both sort of interchangeably between those things. But you're saying it's both. It's what actually happened in terms of events, and it's also how we talk about what happened.
Yes. And yeah. So Arthur Danto has this really fascinating, I think, argument, which I actually think most more biblical scholars should know of it, where he says, listen, let's imagine that you have the perfect historical critical narrative, right? Like, imagine what is the telos of historical criticism, right?
What is the ultimate goal? Yeah.
Yeah. And he says the ultimate goal is something he calls the ideal chronicle. And what that would mean is at every moment of time, there is some supernatural being or supernatural computer, whatever you want to say it is, right? Who is writing or taking down everything that happens perfectly at that moment. It's a neutral, unbiased.
Every single microsecond everywhere in the world.
Yep. And it's written down perfectly, right? And it even gets into human motivations. So it even tells you like why it was done. So not only what was done, but why it was done. Every moment is written down. This is what happened at this microsecond. This happens at this microsecond. And you have a perfect account of everything that's happened across the world. And you can just, and it's accessible to you, right? That's the perfect ultimate telos of historical critical method, he thinks.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so then he says, okay, well, there are some problems with this, right? He says, we see that this actually isn't what we call history when we're writing history. This is something else. To write a history, to write to understanding of the past, he thinks that you need, he calls them narrative senses or basically things. And the main point here is that to understand the past, you have to understand where it fits in a larger story. And so you need to understand the past. You have to understand sort of what happens in the future. And there's like a future-oriented move to understand the past. And so he says, listen, he gives a couple examples. He said there's things called future-oriented indexicals, right? These are really complicated terms.
Gosh.
Yeah, don't worry about that. It's really simple. Like I can give you a simple example to make it really clear. He says, imagine you have a time travel, which he's a philosopher, and philosophers, you know, love these crazy time travel zombie, you know, brains in jars.
Yeah.
But he says, imagine you have a time traveler, and they go in the past, and they see, like, the birth of Abraham Lincoln. Okay, what does the ideal chronicle say at the birth of Abraham Lincoln? The ideal chronicle says, you know, at this moment, the mother gave birth. Now the baby cries. Now the baby, you know, gets fed. Now the baby, you know, and it's just like a momentary. Yeah, it's just a momentary. Yeah, right, exactly. Right, a man, a boy named Abraham. But the time traveler says, oh, the future savior of the Union was born today. You know what I mean? Like the man who saved the Union was born today.
For our British listeners, Abraham Lincoln was...
yeah, thank you for that. Yeah.
The guy who won the American Civil War.
Yeah, exactly.
In the 19th century, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So a very important, significant historical figure.
Yes, he's the greatest president, in my opinion, right? The United States.
Wow, yeah.
Probably not as good as your guys' kings, but anyways.
I'm not sure.
And so he says that even that, like he says, you can see already that like the ideal chronicle isn't writing history. It's doing something else. It is recording the bare physical events. But history would say the president of the United States was born this day. And there's another one. He says project verbs. So he says, listen, what was the idea? Let's imagine you go outside, you know, and I'm sure you've got a good British garden, right? And you're digging around the British garden with the hedgerow and you're planting roses, right? He says, what does the ideal chronicle say? Well, at this moment it says you shoved your spade in the ground and dug up some dirt. And the next moment you put some seeds in the ground. At the next moment, you're watering a random patch of grass. But it can't say you're planting roses. Because for that to have happened, you need to have a broader, wider spectrum.
That's a unifying teleological significance, right?
Yes.
It's saying the purpose of what I'm doing as well as just the facts of what I'm doing.
Yep. And then he has this thing called temporal structures, which is the same thing. He's like, think about the words like the Renaissance or the American Civil War again, right?
Or the Renaissance, if you're British.
Yeah, yeah exactly, right? You can't talk about those. The ideal chronicle has no way to talk about those things because it records a moment, a moment, a moment, a moment, a moment. Those are all later temporal structures, narrative sentences that historians place upon the past events of history.
They're interpretations of what happened rather than just what happened.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, for example, you know, the American Civil War, we can call it the American Civil War. If you're in the South, you call it the War Between the States. And if you're really in the South, you call it the War of Northern Aggression, where the North came in and took over. And so those are all different, he says, ways of writing a history that the ideal chronicle has no way to deal with. The ideal chronicle is a failure, right, of what history is, writing history. It's just a bare account of events. And so I think that's an interesting way to think about history is the events that happened, but then it's also the stories we tell about it.
I see. It's the interpretation that we give to them, the significance and why they're significant for us today.
And how we unite them together. Things like that. And I have an analogy that I think is also helpful, which is, you know, think of like the stars in the sky and the chaos of that is. And I think like those are like the events of history. And this is one of my central analogies for thinking about history. And that some of them are shine brighter. I mean, we have easier access to them. And some of them are very dim. It's really hard for us to access them. But we still draw lines between the stars in the sky like the zodiac, right? And so...
Oh, we see patterns and shapes.
Exactly, yeah. Right? And those... So in my opinion, those patterns and shapes don't exist in the same way that the events of history exist. Mm-hmm. Those are human interpretations placed onto the events of history.
Yeah, that's just the way it looks from our particular angle. It looks like there's a bear or a Orion's belt or whatever.
And so I make a distinction, and it's sort of the, I mean, again, I got some pushback by a scholar named Chris Tilling on this, and he and I had a blog post on this, right, discussion about this. But in my opinion, they don't exist in the same way, to the same level that the events of history exist, right? And you can have some discussion, philosophical discussion about what existence is and what reality is, but I don't think that they exist in the same way, mm-hmm. that they are human interpretations placed upon the events of the past that you said, that we sort of group together and make sense of the events of history.
And there, in many ways, that's the most significant piece, which is what's weird, right? Is that's what makes history meaningful to us, important to us.
Yes.
And it's inherently subjective, right? So removing our subjectivity, which is kind of the point of the historical method, right? Is to completely remove our subjectivity, get at the objective ideal
Just
chronicle.
Objective facts.
But actually, if you did that perfectly, like the ideal chronicle does, you no longer mm-hmm. have anything that matters to us. And so
that's true. I mean, you could try applying the idea of chronicle to the resurrection of Jesus as well. Mm. And all you get is just a sequence of rather somewhat uninteresting events about different objects in space moving around. But we care about the resurrection because of the way we interpret it. It's significance for us, right?
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. Trying to say that the ideal chronicle, the neutrality in that objectivity is a really important point. Because then that moves into another sort of piece that I want to think about, is that the historical method does make claims for, you know, neutrality and objectivity. And the really good ones will sort of have this initial like, no, I'm not, I realize there's no neutrality, but I'm just, we can get our best. They sort of have these hedges, but really their method is neutrality and objectivity. And they think that's the solution after they put up sort of their, you know, like, oh, no, I'm not doing this, but then they do it. And so I think that Danto and then a guy named Hayden White, who was pretty influenced by another of these thinkers in the philosophy of history, really say that what matters. They both matter. The events do matter. The resurrection of Jesus does matter, right? I care if he rose from the dead, and I do think he rose from the dead, and I think that that's a real historical event. But maybe what matters more, or what's more powerful, is these stories that we organize the events by. And he thinks those are not objective, they're not neutral, they are told by people who have interests and who have desires. And actually, this is also another interesting part, so much so that even the events in some ways are even determined by the stories that we tell. So I always give this example, and particularly when I'm talking, I have a section on N.T. Wright where I challenge some of the things he says, and I say this, the stories that we tell matter a lot, and they even can determine what events we consider are in the sky, what stars are in the sky, what events are real. Because as Christians talking to another, is Jesus walking on water, is that an event of the past? Or is that sort of if you're a non-Christian, you will not consider that to be an event of the past because your story tells you that that can't have happened, right? Historical criticism tells you that Jesus walking in water couldn't have happened, so it erases it from the events of history. But if you're a Christian, Jesus walking in water could have happened, and so it's placed back into the events of history. And so even the stories that we tell about the past, the organizing of them, does shape even what events we consider as part of the grouping of events. And so I think that these narratives are very powerful, and that, I mean, I'm trying not to use words here that are too loaded, because the pre-understandings we bring. I was going to say prejudices, but that means a bad thing, and I don't mean that in a bad way. But the pre-understanding...
Well, unless we've read a lot of Gadamer, then prejudice is still a bad thing.
Yeah. So the pre-understandings that we bring shape what we see and how we see it. And I think that the historical method thinks that they see with no lenses and that they see the world totally objectively and that the events that they see are the only events that could possibly exist. And Christians say, no, we see the world with a different set of lenses. We see the world with a different story. We draw, you know, the story of a king in the sky, right? Not, you know, who is the King Jesus. And the events of his life are different than the events that the historical critical method tells. And I think we have a different set of events because we come with a different pre-understanding, a different story of what is possible in the world. And something like Hayden White, like, again, he's a secular Hegelian, you know what I mean? He's a philosopher who doesn't believe in Jesus. And he makes those same moves to say, everyone is coming with stories. The history we tell is inherently story-based. It's inherently built on our pre-understandings. And that the Enlightenment historical method is just one more pre-understanding that you bring to the possible telling of historical events. In the same way, the Christian story is one possible understanding you bring to historical understanding of events. And that it is a power move being made by the historical critical method to sort of exclude a Christian understanding, a Christian set of events. And that's why I say Christians, we need to stop pretending. We're playing by a different set of power rules. We're playing by a different set of understandings. We're playing by a different set of inherently, what I think is a contradictory method to the Christian story. So it's time to just stop playing by that poetic. You know, that's what he calls it. Don't play by that understanding. Play by something different.
Well, what is that? What is that something different, though? Like, what are the new Christian principles that replace Trout?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think that's actually the big challenge that is facing the Christian, some Christian writers. And that's partly what I'm trying to do in my project is get more and more people to join me on that. I had set out some possibilities, right, at the end of my work, which would be things like thinking about aesthetics. This is the one I thought was pretty interesting, right? We can tell a more beautiful story of the world. And that the Christian story, and that we need to really think about the beauty that we see and what the history that we tell. I think that's something that I think ways to connect the past and the future. The Christian story, and if you look at scripture, it assumes that there are deep causal connections through time that don't fit correlation, right? And we see that in some of the typologies, right, that are happening in scripture. And and Joseph says he remembers the Exodus, even though that's something impossible, right? Because the Exodus hadn't happened yet. And so there's this, I think the Christian story has some really interesting ways to cross boundaries of time and causation because of God, right? Is basically what I say. So I think that's a way to do it. And then, I mean, those are some of the ways to start thinking about.
So it's an ongoing project, basically.
Yeah, no, it is an ongoing project. And I think that it can't be done by one theologian. It has to be done by historians, New Testament scholars, theologians, all sort of working together to figure out what is our new ways of seeing the world and new methodologies or approaches that can help us rightly see. I mean, so one of the ones I also say is, I think this one's actually really important, is we can say that the story that we are bringing to the text is one that is deeply rooted in Christian tradition, like, you know, creedally, Christian history, and that we think that this reveals to us reality. So I think it's something also based on those things, that the history of the world matches the story that was revealed to us from creation to new creation, and that's something we could also bring, right? So that there are certain paths forward, but all that needs to be continued to work on. So, I mean, I think the historical method is not the right solution, and that Christians need to continue, as you were saying, right, through the ongoing projects of historians, New Testament scholars, and theologians to continue to think about what that method is going to look like. I think there's been a fair amount of books recently talking about why the historical method fails, and then now it's like, what do we do next? I think is a great project for Christians going forward.
Yeah. One of the, I think that last thing you said to me is a really big piece, is to say, you know, we began with this principle of criticism, this idea that everything actually needs to be on a level plane, nothing is privileged. But what we've learned, I think, through the critiques of historicism is that that's not possible. We don't do that, right? These preconceptions that we bring to it mean that there are things that are privileged over others because we stand within a tradition. And we could use kind of different terms to think about that. But recognizing that, right, as historians, that's not purely a bad thing. And so what would it mean to see the tradition that you stand in as a sort of way of privileging certain things as a positive thing, something we can't get rid of anyways, fully? And what does it look like to integrate that into thinking about history, and so that we might have traditions of historical thought bringing forward their stories? And then what kind of categories do we have to think about the conversation between those? That's something that I find quite compelling, we think, going forward. But we still want to do history thoughtfully, rigorously, right? Like, that matters. But how do we do it more honestly? I think that's what I take you to be really helping us see.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Being willing to say we are part of a tradition. This is the people. It's okay for people to offer into the historical writing space new offerings of who they are. Something interesting, right? And so for Christians, it's like, this is our offering that we can give. Historical space of one that is rooted in the Christian tradition, the Christian story. Where we're not ashamed of that, and we think that this reveals the world as it is, right? It has been revealed to us. And I think there's been some really interesting discussions recently of people sort of embracing pre-understandings. I mean, I read two books recently, right? Reading the Bible Theologically by Sirisky and Joseph K. Gordon's Divine Scripture and Human Understanding, where they both are starting to rethink about, like, even their approaches to Scripture are ones where we need to approach it with pre-understandings. We need to be formed in order to read well. And I want to say, yes, we need to be formed to read well Scripture, and we need to be formed to read well history. You know what I mean? In the same way we bring our traditions and who we are to reading the Bible, we should bring who we are as traditions to reading history and not be ashamed of it.
Very, very interesting.
Thank you so much, Seth. This has been so wonderful to chat about these things again.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Barnabas. Thank you so much. This has been a blast to talk about two smart people with your passion, you know what I mean? Like, it makes me like, man, I gotta start figuring out that second book.
That's right. We need a sequel.
That's how we all feel.
Thank you for listening to Faith at the Frontiers. If you liked this episode, then do subscribe to hear more like it in the future. We will be taking a break for Christmas, and we'll be back with more on faith and the challenges of history in mid-January. See you then.